Mother helped, coming every day, handkerchief in hand for her silent tears, but back ramrod straight. She pointed out quirks Dazen never would have remembered, like the way his brother stood when he was thinking, and what foods Gavin loved and what he hated. But the biggest reason for his success had been the real Gavin himself. Gavin had painted Dazen as a false prism. He'd sworn that Dazen deceived his retainers with parlour tricks that would never convince anyone who wasn't criminal or insane, or who stood to benefit by standing with a false prism. Everyone knew there was only ever one prism every generation, so they'd believed the old Gavin implicitly. So from their first glance at Dazen's prismatic eyes, they knew he was Gavin. Those who knew better, who knew that Dazen had never needed parlour tricks, who knew he was as much a prism as Gavin, in other words, Dazen's closest retainers and friends, had been scattered to the four winds after the Battle of Sundered Rock. He'd betrayed them, and if it was a betrayal for the greater good, it still kept him up nights to know that Elysian pirates were selling his people for slaves in 100 ports. He drew up his first list of 7 great purposes, and he did what he could. And through it all, his mother had saved him 1,000 times. She deserved the truth. More, he told her now. It was more of a surprise to him than to anyone that he had a son. He and his men had been living in caves and on the run, and even if he'd had the energy for entertaining some of the camp followers, he'd been heartsick over Caris's engagement to Gavin. Dazen hadn't slept with anyone during the war. She stood and walked to the door, opened it to see that no one was eavesdropping, and returned. Quietly, she said, "So you've adopted your brother's natural son. Why?" "Because you're always bothering me about giving you a grandson," he almost said. But he knew that would wound her. "Because it's the right thing to do? Because Gavin would have?" No, he wasn't sure that Gavin would have. Because the boy had nothing and he deserved a chance? Because Caris was there watching and there was something perversely pleasurable about wounding her by doing what was right? "Because I know what it's like to be alone," Gavin said. He was surprised that it was the truth. "You don't give Caris enough credit," his mother said. "What's she got to do with anything?" His mother just shook her head. "She didn't take it well?"
"You might say that," Gavin said.
"What are you going to do if your father refuses to recognize the boy?"
"He's not moving me on this, mother. I don't do very many things that are right. He's not taking this one away."
She smiled suddenly. "Did it make your list of 7 purposes this time? Defying him?"
"My list only has things that are possible."
"So it's harder than stopping the blood war? Harder than destroying the pirate lords?"
"Twice," Gavin said. "And yes."
"You get that from him, you know."
"What?"
"Your father always made lists, goals to check off. Marry a girl from the right family by 25, join the Spectrum by 40, he made it by 35, and so on. Of course, he never had to organize his life in 7-year blocks."
"Did he never want to be prism himself?" Gavin asked. She didn't answer right away.
"Prisms usually only last 7 years.
"Not long enough for my father, I see. He wanted more sons and daughters, didn't he? Even after Sebastian. More tools, more weapons, in case more went bad." She said nothing.
"I want to go home, Gavin. I've wanted to join the freeing for years. I'm so tired." For a moment, Gavin couldn't breathe. His mother was the very quintessence of life. Beauty, energy, cleverness, good nature. To hear her speak as if she were broken down, as if she wanted to quit, was like a blow to the stomach. "Of course your father will never allow it," she said, smiling sadly. "But whether he allows it or not, sometime in these next 5 years I'm joining. I've buried 2 sons. I will not bury you." So she was just giving him warning, giving him time to prepare. Dear old Hollum, he didn't even want to think about it. His mother had been his only companion, his best advisor, the one person who sniffed out threats from leagues away and loved him no matter what.
"So, what were your 7 purposes? Accomplished any of them yet?" she asked, bringing the conversation back to safe ground, even though she knew he would dodge.
"I learned to fly. Took me most of the last year."
She looked at him like she couldn't tell for once whether he was joking.
"That could prove handy," she said carefully.
Gavin laughed.
"You're serious," she said.
"I'll have to take you for a ride. A flight? Sometime," Gavin said. "You'll love it."
"And you think the idea of that is a good enough distraction to sidetrack me from getting the rest of your goals out of you?"
"Absolutely," Gavin said in mock seriousness. "I learned from the best."
"Very well," she said. "Now get out of here."
He was halfway out the door when she called.
"Gavin?"
She called him Gavin, now always, even when her eyes called him Dazen.
"Be careful. You know how your father is when someone won't do what he wills."
Chapter 50 Kip woke with a dead arm from a dream about his mother holding his head in her lap. It wasn't a dream, it was half-memory. He'd been young. His mother was running her fingers through his hair, her eyes red, swollen. Red eyes usually meant she'd been smoking haze. But this morning she didn't smell of smoke or alcohol.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm so sorry. I've quit. It's going to be different from now on. I promise."
He cracked open one sleep, snot-encrusted eye and moaned.
"That's nice, Mother. Can you just get off my arm?"
He rolled over. He'd slept on the ground. On a carpet. "Oh!" As the blood slowly flooded back into his arm, it started hurting. He rubbed it until feeling returned. Where was he?
Oh, Liv's room.
It was barely dawn. Sitting up, Kip saw a woman coming in the room. Maybe the opening door had woken him. Liv must have slept elsewhere. The covers of the bed weren't even disturbed.
"Good morning, Kip,"
the woman said. She was a dark woman with heavy eyebrows, frizzy hair, and a flamboyant gold scarf around her neck. She was thick, hugely tall, with great heavy shoulders and a bald-patterned green dress draped over her like a sheet over a galleass.
"It's dawn, and time for your first lesson. I'm Mistress Hallel."
"You're my magister?" Kip said,
still rubbing his hurting arm.
"Oh, yes."
She smiled, but the smile didn't touch her eyes.
"And you'll remember today's lesson for the rest of your life. Get up, Kip."
Kip stood. She walked past him and opened a door to a small balcony outside Liv's room.
"Come quickly," she said. "You need to see this before the sun is fully over the horizon."
Hair squashed, mouth full of cotton, breath foul, arm throbbing, Kip licked his dry lips and stepped past Mistress Hallel. Her eyes were dark and intense. So dark that he couldn't even tell what colour of a drafter she was. Weird. Here I'm supposed to see minute differentiations in colours undetectable to most people, and I couldn't even see the colour in her irises. He stepped onto the pure yellow Luxin balcony. Aside from streaks of water or dirt, the entire thing was eerily clear. Despite his experience yesterday, learning that the yellow was one of the strongest materials known, Kip tested his weight on the balcony gingerly. It was, of course, solid. Due to the way the towers all leaned out as if blossoming, if Kip fell from here, he'd smash on the rocks several hundred feet below, just shy of the water. It was even worse for the floors above them, which leaned even farther out. He gulped and tried to pay attention to the rising sun.
"We don't have all day, Kip,"
Mistress Hallel said. There was something in her voice, a tension. Kip turned as she stepped out onto the balcony with him. At first he thought she was tripping, because she lunged forward so suddenly. He moved toward her to catch her. If there was one thing good about being fat, it was that he could stop big weights. But Mistress Hallel extended both of her hands like battering rams. Kip's move forward brought him between her arms. Her thumbs scratched across his chest and off both sides. She cursed as they crushed together in an awkward hug.
"I've got you," Kip said. "Don't worry, you're not going to—"
The big woman stood to her full height, regaining her balance. She was much taller than Kip, and the move pressed big, flat breasts onto either side of his face. Somehow his chin got caught in her dress's gaping neckline as she stood, and for a brief, but not nearly brief enough, moment, Kip's face was fully engulfed in flabby cleavage.
"Gah!"
Kip blurted.
Mistress Hallel was already bending over, mercifully freeing her neckline of Kip's chin, but then bending farther, her body pressing against his. After an experience that he was doubtless going to relive in dreams, and not the good kind, he sidled out of the way. The woman's big meaty hands slapped on Kip's right and left legs. His move to the side made her left hand slip off his right leg, though. Then she lifted.
"What are you—"
Kip stopped as soon as he saw her eyes. Dead concentration. Complete lack of emotion. She pushed forward hard into Kip, lifting. He put it all together far too slowly. The intensity. The story. The lack of colour in her eyes, the stumble that hadn't been a stumble. It had been a lunge. The lack of embarrassment at Kip being pressed against her breasts, because you don't let the touch of a little flesh deter you. Not when you've come to kill. Kip's hands slapped against the edge of the balcony behind him. With only one leg in her hands, Mistress Hallel lifted sharply. She was so strong that Kip's weight was no problem for her. If he'd been a brave man, Kip would have fought her. If he'd been flexible, he would let her pick up the one leg while he stood on the other and beat her to a bloody pulp. Instead, Kip took the fatty's way. He went limp, floppy, making all his weight dead weight, seeking the ground the way he'd done when Ram would try to show off by picking him up and throwing him on the ground. If Kip collapsed, Ram could never lift him. Where if he held himself rigid, Ram could hold his weight easily. Mistress Hallel brought one hand off Kip's left leg, seeking a grip anywhere on his round body. Kip wriggled like a fish, pushing off the balcony, trying to push himself back into the tower. She pinned him against the corner of the balcony with her own substantial weight and drew back her left hand to punch him. But the floor called him, and without her strong arm to hold him, Kip answered. Her fist descended and landed a glancing blow, but Kip fell. She lost her hold, and he went turtle, barely keeping a grip on his pant leg. Cursing, she tried to lift him by that alone. His pants ripped, and then slipped off his waist. They tangled around his knees, but however his baggy pants hampered his movements, they did nothing to help the assassin lift him either. She cursed him and punched his leg, taking a wide stance to pound him. He yelped. Then she slugged him in the stomach, taking his breath away. She snarled. "Take your death like a man!" Kip bit her ankle. The assassin cried out and fell on top of him. She recovered enough to land knee first on his chest. Then she angled her fall so she crushed and trapped him. Apparently Kip wasn't the only one who knew how to use his weight to good advantage. She landed with her head toward his feet. She trapped one of Kip's legs in one iron hand. Then she punched his thigh. She caught it dead center. It was like being kicked by a horse. He screamed. Then she grabbed his other leg. No amount of thrashing could break her grip. It was hard to even breathe with her on top of him, her legs crushing his face. She pummeled his other leg, and it too went dead. She pushed herself up and punched him in the groin. Stars flashed in front of Kip's eyes. Any thought of counterattack fled. He just wanted to curl into a ball. Her weight shifted, crushing him again, and then she stood. She had one of his ankles in each of her hands, and she lifted him easily. She was going to toss him over the balcony. Dear Orholm. There was nothing he could do to stop it. Eyes squinted in pain, weakly thrashing. Kip saw a thin beam of superviolet Luxin stick to the assassin's head.
"Stop it! Drop him now!"
a young woman screamed from inside the room. "Liv?" The assassin snarled a curse and turned toward Liv just as a yellow Luxin ball blasted from her hands, zipped along the superviolet line, and exploded in a blinding flash against the assassin's face. Mistress Hallel dropped Kip, lifting a hand to protect herself too late, and staggered backward. She was so tall that the rail of the balcony caught her below the waist. She hit it hard and tottered. Her meaty hands slapped onto the rail as she went on tip-toe feet seeking purchase. Kip, lying on the ground, slid a hand under her foot and lifted. Not hard, he was in so much pain he could barely move, but it was enough. The assassin felt herself going over the edge and scrambled. She fell and caught herself on the rail of the balcony. Through the clear yellow of the balcony she swung face to face with Kip. Each balcony had a small gap for rainwater to sluice off so it wouldn't fill with water, and the big woman's face was barely a foot from Kip's own. Kip looked at her. He knew how this ended. Some skinny woman might be able to pull her weight up, but not a woman this size. Kip was strong. He could lift heavier things than Samson or even Ram, but when you were really big, heaving your entire weight over a ledge was impossible, and this woman was much bigger than he was. Mistress Hellel heaved, and for one terrifying moment Kip thought he was wrong. Her elbows bent, and her body lifted. She swung one heavy leg to the side, trying to reach it high enough to reach the rain gap in the balcony. Then her strength gave out, and she swung back to vertical. She was finished. Kip could see it in her eyes.
"Light cannot be chained, little guile," she said. "And that blind you. Mort smite you to the 10th generation. Belphegor, blight your sons. Etterat, spit on your mother's grave. Ferrox, corrupt your father's—"
Kip punched her through the rain gap. Her nose crunched in a spray of blood. She must have been expecting the blow because she tried to snag his fist, but missed. She fell, flailing all the way, screaming something, but Kip couldn't make out the words. She slammed into a sharp boulder not 5 paces from the crashing waves of the Cerulean Sea, and her body actually burst asunder, a piece, a leg, shearing off and flying to splash into the water as the rest of her crunched in one long, bloody smudge. It didn't seem real. Part of Kip knew that could have been him, maybe should have been him, but he was suddenly aware of Liv standing just inside her apartments.
"Kip, Kip, we killed her," Liv was saying.
Kip was more aware that his balls were aching, and he was pretty much naked in front of the only girl he knew, and he was fat and gross and should cover himself immediately. He'd barely hiked up his pants by the time Liv lurched to the balcony rail and vomited. Kip hated throwing up. He hated himself throwing up, and he hated other people throwing up, but worst, he discovered, as the wind blew across the yellow tower and carried mist through the rain gap, Kip hated being thrown up on. Little misty wetness clung to his face and in his open mouth. He rolled over, spitting and coughing and slapping at his own face to wipe off puke mist. He rolled to his feet, balls still aching, face scrunched.
"Oh, no," Liv said, her face grey and mortified, realizing she'd thrown up on him.
She looked from him to his crotch, where his pants were torn, and then to the rocks so far below. She struggled for words and found none.
"You know, I'm glad things aren't awkward between us," Kip said.
Did I really just say that? It was like part of him couldn't help being totally inappropriate. He'd just killed someone, and he was so terrified and pained and embarrassed and mortified and thankful to be alive, and he didn't even know what all else. He couldn't help himself. Liv's mouth twitched up for half a moment, and then she leaned back over the rail and vomited again. Always something to say. Never the right thing. Well done, Kip.
Chapter 51.
"Midsummer is coming," the wight said. "Sunday."
Gavin stood in front of her on the top of the Chromeria. Together they were waiting for the sun to rise. Midsummer, as far as Gavin was concerned, was always coming.
"I've started preparations for the freeing," she said. "Do you think your father will commune this year?"
Gavin snorted. "Not this year. Not ever." He rubbed his temples. He hadn't slept.
"It's not natural," the wight said quietly. "I used to marvel at his self-control, you know, living in that awful room, keeping his mind sharp, keeping the nightmares at bay."
"Nightmares have to keep him at bay."
"I live half in darkness, Gavin," the wight said as if he hadn't interrupted. "That's how it feels to live without drafting. But to live fully in darkness, is that not a denial of Orholm himself? They love the darkness, for their deeds are dark and the light shames them."
"I'll leave the state of my father's soul to my father. Are we not to honour our fathers, rendering obedience unto the authority the father of all has entrusted to them?"
"You're not just a son, Gavin, you're the prism. You should honour Orholm by practising the authority he's given you, not just the power."
"Maybe it's time for you to be freed," Gavin said bitterly. He had these conversations at least once a year. He was sick of it. The White asked after his father suggested the White go first. Both pressured him to pressure the other. The White held her hands out, palms up.
If you command it, my prism, I will join the freeing, gladly.
Her words stopped him cold. She meant it.
I also obey, the White said. It might surprise you to learn it, Gavin, but I drew the straw to become the White before I began to understand what it was to even be a drafter, much less a colour, much less the White. But perhaps it is not a lesson that can be taught, only learned.
What are you talking about? Gavin asked.
Do you know why faith is harder for us, my Lord Prism?
The White grinned. Sometimes, despite her years, she seemed a mischievous girl.
Because we know Orholam sleeps 100 years for every day he wakes? Gavin asked.
He was tired, and not just from the insomnia. She refused the bait.
Because we know ourselves. Because others obey us as though we were gods, and we know we're not. We see the fragility of our own power, and through it we see the fragility of every other link. What if the Spectrum suddenly refused my orders? Not hard to imagine when you consider the scheming and lust for power it takes to become a colour. What if a general suddenly refuses his satrap's orders? What if a son refuses his father's orders? What if that first link in the great chain of being, or Orholam himself, is as empty as every other link before him? Seeing the weakness of each link, we think the great chain itself is fragile. Surely at any moment it will burst if we don't do everything in our power to hold it together.
Gavin swallowed involuntarily. He'd never really universalized the thought as she was doing, but he always thought his whole life was like that. His deceptions, his authority, his imprisoned brother, his relationships. A chain of wet paper, drooping under its own sodden weight. A chain to which he added new weight every day.
"Here's what I've learned," the White said. "Orholam doesn't need me. I can do good work for him, work that pleases him, and if I foul it, others will suffer. You see, what I do still matters, but in the end Orholam's will prevails. So I think I still have work to do. I see unfinished business everywhere I look. But if you tell me that I should be freed this midsummer's, I will do so gladly. Not because I have faith in you, Gavin, though I do, more than you know, but because I have faith in Orholam."
Gavin looked at her like she was a visitor from the moon.
That was very metaphysical. Can we talk about the freeing now?
She laughed.
Here's the thing, Gavin. You remember everything. I know you do. You think I'm crazy now, but you'll remember this, and some day it might make a difference. And with that, I can be content.
Madwoman or saint. But then, Gavin didn't think there was any difference.
"I'm going to Garriston," he said.
She folded her hands in her lap and turned toward the rising light.
"Let me explain," Gavin rushed to say.
Then he did, ignoring the beauty of the sunrise. 10 minutes later he was almost finished when the White raised a finger. She held her breath, then sighed as the sun itself mastered the horizon.
"Do you ever watch for the green flash?"
"Sometimes," Gavin said.
He knew people who swore they'd seen it, though no one could explain what it was or why it happened, and he knew others who swore it was a myth.
"I think of it as Orholam's wink," the White said. "Is everything about Orholam with her? Maybe she is fading."
"You've seen it?" Gavin asked.
"Twice. The first time was 59 years ago now. No, 60. It was the night I met Albert."
Gavin had to reach to remember the name. "Oh, Albert Rathcore, the White's husband and quite a famous man in his day. Dead now 20 years.
I was at a party, quite disgusted, with the drunk young gentleman who'd escorted me there, and most certainly wasn't going to be escorting me home. I went outside to get some air, watched the sun set, saw the green flash, and was so excited I jumped. Unfortunately, this very tall fellow was leaning over me to grab his wine glass that he'd left on the balcony, and I broke his nose with the back of my head."
"You met Albert Rathcore by breaking his nose?"
"The woman he was escorting that night was none too pleased. She was beautiful, graceful, prettier than I was by half, and somehow she couldn't compete with little clumsy me. Though I can't imagine she would have been happy if she'd married Albert. Your grandmother didn't forgive me for 2 years."
"My grandmother?"
"If I hadn't seen the green flash at that instant, your grandmother would have married Albert, and you wouldn't be here now, Gavin. The White laughed. See, you never know what you'll learn when you let old women prattle.
Gavin was left speechless.
You can go to Garriston, of course, Gavin. But no one else can perform the freeing, and it can be done at no other time, so there's only one option. I'll send all those to be freed to Garriston. I'll have to send our fastest ships to intercept theirs so they can arrive in time.
We're talking about war, Gavin said.
And?
What do you mean, and? He demanded. I'm not going to have time to throw parties and set off fireworks and give speeches.
The list I have so far is only perhaps 150 drafters. Not a large flight this year. A good proportion of those definitely won't make it to next year. You want another 80 or 90 colour whites?
Of course not.
The parties are nice, Gavin, but understand what you are. This is the flip side of your first purpose.
She'd figured out that he'd sworn to wipe out colour whites because of Sebastian. Like everything she learned, she used it to control him.
Even if you don't believe the prism is Orholm's gift to mankind, they do. The minutes each drafter spends with you being freed are the holiest moments of her life. You can take that away, but it would be the worst thing you could do. I, for one, can forgive you much, but I'd never forgive you that.
That stung.
Now, tell me how you dropped off Caris in Tyria, killed the Geist, and brought back a son all within a few days. The trip alone should have taken you 2 weeks.
Well, that was quick. He'd known she would learn of the Skimmer and the Condor as soon as he'd shown Caris, but he hadn't been able to stop himself. Maybe he was impulsive. So he told her about the Skimmer and the Condor. Her eyes lit up.
That would be something to see, Gavin. Flying? And the speed! I suppose you'll want to go back to Garriston the same way?
Yes, and I'm taking Kip with me. Again she surprised him and didn't protest.
Good, she said. It will be good for you to learn about a father's love.
Because I sure as the Evernight didn't learn about that from my own father. Then Gavin realized that was exactly what she meant, and he bristled. But there was no point fighting over his father again. So what was the second time? He asked instead.
Second time?
The second time you saw the green flash. The second time Orholm winked. He kept the sarcasm out of his voice. Mostly. She smiled.
I look forward to the day when I tell you that, my Lord Prism, but that day is not today.
And then her smile passed.
When you return, we need to talk about Kip's testing.
You noticed the war crystals. I thought I stopped it in time.
Old, yes. Addled, not yet.
You want to hear me admit it? Kip nearly broke the test, Gavin said. Like Dazen did.
Or worse, passed it,
the White said.
Chapter 52
Caris knew she was even deeper in trouble than she'd feared within 5 minutes of being captured. King Haradul's mirror men walked her at gunpoint over to a wagon. They didn't bind her hands, which she thought was curious, and gave her a momentary hope. Then the mirror men handed her off to half a dozen drafters, all women. Two mirror men stayed, their pistols levelled at her head, barely blinking. The women, two reds, a green, a blue, and a super, stripped her naked and searched her and her clothes, quickly finding her eye caps. The two mirror men barely even glanced at her body, and though men around the camp turned to see whatever they could between all the drafters surrounding her, there wasn't a single ribald comment. Disciplined, damn it. Crossing her arms over her breasts, Caris looked down, feigning embarrassment. Well, maybe not completely feigning.
Eyes up! One of the Reds commanded.
Caris looked up. They wanted to see her eyes, so they would know as soon as she tried to draft. Smart, too. Damn it, twice. In rapid order they went through all her clothing, scrunching every seam to look for hidden pockets. Then they went through her bag, one carefully cataloguing all the items in a codex. After they'd found everything, Caris hoped they'd give her back her clothes. No such luck. Instead, they opened the door of the wagon and threw a violet dress and shift inside.
"Get in,"
the same Red who'd spoken before said. Caris got in and the door slammed behind her. She heard a bar being lowered and chains pulled into place. The inside of the wagon was fairly spacious, There was a pallet to sleep on, a chamber pot, a cup of water, several blankets and pillows. All violet, the deepest into the blue spectrum they could find. And from the noxious smell, all freshly painted. The windows were fitted with bars and violet glass, draped on the outside with violet cloth. Apparently they were taking her drafting seriously, and from their study of her eyes and the mag torches, they knew she could draft green and red. Rather than risk a colour that was between her colours, they'd picked the one farthest to the end of the spectrum she didn't draft. It was a strange kindness. They could have just blindfolded her, of course, but blindfolds slip. But most captors would have painted the wagon black and made her live in darkness. This was just as effective, but a lot more work. If a drafter couldn't see her colour or didn't have lenses and white light, she couldn't draft. Caris was about as close to helpless as she got. She hated the feeling with a passion. She threw on the slip and the shapeless violet dress and immediately scratched the paint. It had been heat-dried by a sub-red. She would be able to chip it eventually, but with the only light coming in through the violet curtains and violet glass, it wasn't going to matter anyway. Still, she tried. She couldn't help herself. Under the layer of violet paint was a layer of black. Under that, the wood was a dark mahogany. No luck. The wagon began rolling within minutes. That night, after she was fed a hunk of black bread and given water in a blackened iron cup, two drafters came in, their skin already full of red and blue Luxin respectively. Behind them came, of all things, a tailor. She was a tiny woman who barely came up to Caris's shoulder. She took Caris's measurements rapidly, never writing them down, just committing them to memory. Then she stared at Caris's body for a long time, studying her like a farmer studying a rocky side hill that he needed to plough. She double-checked her measurement of Caris's hips and then left without a word. Over the next 5 days, Caris learned little. Apparently her wagon was close to the cooking wagons because all she heard all day was the rattle of pots at every bump in the road. The shadowy figures of horsemen, maybe mirror men, sometimes passed close enough to her covered windows for her to see their silhouettes. If they spoke, though, she could never make out the words. At night she was given food in a blackened iron bowl, with a blackened iron spoon, and black bread and water. Never wine. Damn them, they even thought of the red of wine. A mirrorman accompanied by a drafter took her chamber pot, bowl, spoon, and cup each night after sunset. When she kept the spoon one night, hiding it under a pillow, they didn't say a word. Neither did they give her water the next day. When she surrendered the spoon, she was given water again. The boredom was the worst. There were only so many push-ups you could do in a day, and anything more strenuous was impossible. There were no musical instruments, no books, and certainly no weapons or drafting to practice. On the sixth night, two blues came in. "Choose a position that's comfortable," one of them said. Caris sat on her little pallet, hands folded in her lap, ankles crossed, and they bound her arms and legs in about 5 times the amount of Luxin necessary. Then they put violet spectacles over her eyes and left. King Haradul entered the wagon carrying a folding camp chair. He wore a loose black shirt over his shirt, which Caris could barely see, and voluminous black pants over his pants. Caris understood being careful around her, but this was ridiculous. The king settled into the camp chair. He stared at her, wordlessly. "I don't suppose you remember me," he said. "I met you once, before the war. Of course, I was just a boy. 3 years younger than you, and you were already head over heels for, well, one of the Guile boys. I can't remember which. Maybe you can't either. There seemed to be some confusion for a time, wasn't there?" "You're a real charmer, aren't you?" Caris asked. "You might be surprised," he said. He shook his head. "I always thought you were a beautiful girl. But the stories of you took on a life of their own. A tragic love triangle between the two most powerful men in the world sort of demands a beautiful girl, doesn't it? I mean, otherwise, why would two men tear the world apart? For her insights about history? Her witty repartee? No, you were a pretty girl made beautiful by the bard's need to make some sense of what you wrought." "Don't get me wrong," he said. "I was so in love with you it kept me up nights. You were my first, great, unrequited love. I'm sure you've had many. Or do women pretend to find you attractive now that you're king?
Carys asked.
"Temper, Carys, temper." But the truth was, it wasn't the Red that made her say that. She'd always hated to perform for others, to do just what they wanted. He scowled. The shrewish tongue somehow was omitted from the panegyrics. Or is that a new addition?
I feel a bit freer to speak my mind these days. I already destroyed the world. What's one man's ego? Carys said.
Carys, I was on my way to pay you a compliment before you made us descend to this unpleasantness.
Oh, dear. Please do go on, then. There's nothing that would mean more to me than to hear praises from the Butcher of Recton.
He rubbed his palms together thoughtfully. I'm sorry you had to see that, Carys.
He kept using her name. She didn't like it.
I hope you know I took no joy in what I ordered there. But I also hope you understand that that small monstrosity will forestall larger ones in the future. You're familiar with a manuscript called The Counselor to Kings?
Yes, Carys said. Loathsome advice and cruelty that not even he had the stomach to countenance when he himself ruled.
The counselor asked whether it was better for a ruler to be loved or feared. Both was best, he decided, but if a ruler had to choose, he should always choose to be feared. His advice was good. He was simply personally weak. I don't hold that against him. The fact is, Carys, when kings aren't feared, they end up having to instill fear eventually at grievous prices. That's what happened at Rue. That's what happened at Garriston. Those men you loved, or at least bedded, learned the lesson eventually, but because they learned it late, what they had to do was far worse than destroying one little village. So tell me, how can you hold the death of 1,000 against me, but not the death of 10s of thousands, 100s of thousands against them?
Carys hadn't been allowed to see the royal steps at Rue, stained with the blood and shit of hundreds murdered coldly one at a time and thrown down the steps to the gaping, horrified crowds below.
She'd been kept from going to Garriston even after the war, where 10s of thousands, they didn't even know how many, had perished in the Red Luxin fires of the besieged city. That was Gavin's and Dazen's doing. Somehow it had never seemed possible that men she knew so well would have done such things. Men she thought she knew so well. The people of this land are my people. I am no mere satrap, no guardian of some other man's land. I am king. These people belong to me. To kill 1,000 of my own was to cut a chunk out of my own flesh. But cancers have to be cut out. I am this land. My people work this land and bring forth crops at my good pleasure. I protect them and provide for them, and they in turn must render to me of their crops and of their sons. Those who would not are rebels, traitors, thieves, and heretics, apostates. They defy the holy compact. To defy me is to defy the God's order. I had to do this because my father wouldn't. If he had hanged 6 mares when they first defied him and refused to send levies, that 1,000 would be alive now. He was weak and wanted to be loved. No one may acknowledge it during my life, but by killing that 1,000 in Recton, I saved many more. This is what it is to be a king.
You're awfully passionate in your defense of decapitating babies and stacking their heads.
The God's order? Not Orholm's? Carys, you're making me understand why men beat their wives.
King Haradul rubbed his black beard but made no move to strike her.
By making the display so awful, I ensured it would be seared into every mind that saw it. Do you think the dead care what happened to their bodies? Better that their example save the living than that I bury them all in a hole and my descendants have to kill their descendants. That monument will stay for 12 generations. That is the legacy I will leave to my children's children, a secure rule without the need to commit such massacres themselves. And the reason I tell you, Carys, is that I had hoped you of all people might understand. You're a woman now, not some frightened little girl surrounded by great men. You're a woman who's seen great men and terrible deeds. I had hoped you might understand the burdens of greatness, at least a little. Perhaps I give you too much credit.
Carys swallowed, trembling with rage and maybe a little fear. And there was a sick logic to everything he said, but she had seen the bodies, the blood, the piled-up heads.
As I wanted to say earlier, King Haradul said. He took a deep breath, clearly pushing away his frustration, and continued. You were a very pretty girl,
but only pretty despite the tails. But you, to my great delight and surprise, are one of the few women I've ever seen who's gotten more beautiful as you've aged. You look better at 30 than you did at 20, and I wouldn't be surprised if you look better at 40 than you do now. Of course, I'm sure it helps that you haven't squeezed 6 or 10 brats out of your crotch. Most pretty girls do manage to find a husband before they get so old, but let's not look a gift horse in the mouth.
Real charmer. What was it with King Caradoc? Did he just say everything that popped into his idiot head?
Yours is indeed a face to inspire poets. This, however, he gestured to her vaguely. She wasn't sure what he meant. This must change. You have shoulders like a man.
The bastard. How did he know how much she hated her shoulders? Whenever the fashions were such that she could hide her shoulders, they showed off her upper arms, or vice versa. And he'd said exactly what she said to herself at least once a week. I have shoulders like a man. But the king wasn't done.
Your ass looks like a 10-year-old boy's. Maybe it's that dress.
We'll hope so.
And your breasts. Your poor, magnificent breasts. Where have they gone? They were bigger when you were 15. Your training ends now. I'll allow you to resume dancing and riding when you no longer resemble a starved, dark forest pygmy.
I won't be here that long, Caris said. She frowned. Had she just admitted she looked like a starved pygmy?
Caris, my dear, I've waited for you for 15 years, and whether or not you know it, you've been waiting for me, too. You and I don't settle for second best. Why else would you still be unmarried? So we can wait a few months. I'll come visit you when your dress is done.
He glanced around.
Oh, and I noticed you've nothing in here to entertain you. It must get boring. It's good for a woman to excel in the pleasant arts. I'll have my mother's psantria brought in for you. That's what you play, isn't it?
He smiled and went out.
The worst part of it was that Caris did feel thankful. A little.
The bastard.
Chapter 53. Kip and Liv went straight to the blackguards watching the lift.
We need to see the prism, Liv said.
Who are you?
The man asked. It was short. Parian, of course, and built like a cornerstone. He looked at Kip.
Oh, are you the prism's bastard?
He coughed.
Nephew?
Yes, I'm his bastard, Kip said angrily. We need to see him now.
The blackguard looked over at his compatriot, a man just as muscular but toweringly tall.
We've had no orders on how the prism wants his nephew treated, the man said. He just went to sleep not 20 minutes ago, the other said, after being up all night.
It's an emergency, Liv said.
They seemed unmoved, a little of a who-the-hell-is-this-girl creeping into their faces.
Someone just tried to kill me, Kip said.
Stump! Get the commander,
the tall one said. Stump. The short blackguard's name was actually Stump, because the blackguards were both Parian, who traditionally had descriptive names like Iron Fist. Kip had no idea if that was a nickname or really his name.
He took third watch last night,
Stump said, his mouth twisting.
Stump!
Pulling rank.
All right, I'm going.
Stump left, and the taller blackguard turned and rapped on the door 3 times, pause, 2 times. Then, after 5 seconds, he repeated it. A room slave opened the door almost before the blackguard finished knocking. A pretty woman with the unsettlingly pale skin and red hair of a blood forester. She was fully dressed and alert, despite the early hour and the darkness of the chamber behind her.
Maricia, Liv said, so good to see you again.
Her voice didn't sound totally sincere. The slave appeared none too pleased to see Liv. Kip wondered why Liv had used the slave's name then. He thought you were only supposed to do that with slaves with whom you were friendly. From deep in the chamber they heard Gavin's voice, deep and scratchy from just waking.
Give me a...
Whatever else he said, it was lost in bass and pillows. A moment later all the windows banged open and light streamed in from all sides, nearly blinding everyone, and eliciting a loud groan from the prism on his bed.
That's brilliant magic, Liv said. Look at that, Kip.
She pointed at a dark purplish-black strip of glass around the glass walls that encircled the whole chamber.
What are you Are you forgetting why we're here? Kip asked. Oh, sorry.
Gavin was squinting at them. Maricia, copy, please. The woman bobbed.
First closet, third from the left.
Then she left.
Copies in the closet? Gavin asked. What the hell? Who puts copy? And why aren't you serving me?
The door closed behind her.
And where's my favourite shirt?
Oh, closet.
Damned woman.
Clearly a morning person,
Liv said under her breath. Kip snorted before he could stop himself. Gavin had been looking down as if feeling trapped, but now he shot Kip a look. This had better be important. He threw off his covers and walked toward the closet. He wasn't wearing anything. Kip had seen Gavin's forearms with hemp ropes for muscles, and he'd known his father was lean, but seeing his whole body was half awe-inspiring and half a slap in the face. Kip's shoulders were as broad as Gavin's, and his arms were probably as big around as Gavin's, but even now, not after exertion, not filled from hard labour, but now, after sleeping, Gavin's body was one smooth curving muscle meeting another, over and over, without an ounce of softness anywhere. Apparently sculling and skimming around the entirety of the seven satrapies did that to a man.
How did I come to this?
Next to him, Kip grew aware of Liv, staring, open-mouthed. She didn't avert her eyes, even as Gavin had to rummage through the closet.
Liv,
Kip said under his breath.
What?
She asked, glancing away, her cheeks bright.
He's the prism. It's practically my religious duty to give him my full attention.
Gavin, who'd seemed oblivious to them, grabbed some clothing and said, without looking at them, Anna, staring is rude. Liv blushed harder and sank into herself, horrified.
Her name's Liv, Kip said.
I know her name. Now, what is it?
Gavin demanded, pulling on a dazzling white silk shirt with gold piping. The door opened behind Kip, and Maricia and Commander Ironfist stepped into the room. Ironfist stopped at the door while Maricia brought in a tray with a silver service on it and three cups. She poured a dark, creamy, steaming brew into one cup and handed it to Gavin, whose pants and sleeves were still unlaced.
Commander? Kip? Gavin asked, motioning to the other cups. I think Liv is quite alert enough already.
Liv looked like she wanted to fall through the floor. Kip grinned. Ironfist helped himself to the copy, while Maricia took over dressing Gavin. Kip picked up a cup too. But as he picked up the carafe, his hands started shaking so badly he couldn't even try to fill his cup.
Someone tried to throw me off the balcony, Kip said.
It was like the words made it real. One moment ago, he'd been joking with Liv, thinking about how unlike his father he was, and grinning when Liv got embarrassed. Now the reality of how close he'd come to getting thrown to his death came crashing in on him. He could see himself falling, twisting, helpless, like in an awful dream, and then his body bursting like a juicy grape. And who would have suspected anything? The woman could have slipped into his room, thrown him off the balcony, and then simply left. Even if they'd figured out who was on the floor at the time, who would expect a big woman as an assassin? People would have thought Kip had broken after his testing and jumped. No one would have known. And who would have cared? Kip felt a great gnawing emptiness in his chest. He'd never been part of anything. Even back in Recton he hadn't belonged. Too fat and awkward for Issa, too smart to feel a connection to Samson, who seemed a whisker away from simple. Relentlessly mocked by Ram, too young for Liv. He had thought that being part of the Chromeria would make him be part of something for the first time in his life. He was going to be different here, too. He would be different and alone no matter where he went.
Orholm, why had he even stopped that woman from throwing him over?
2 moments of terror, sure, and a mess of exploded Kip on the rocks, but the terror would end, everything would end, and the sea would wash away the mess. Someone slapped him. Kip staggered, rubbed his jaw.
Make the words, Kip, Gavin said.
So Kip told them everything. Liv stared woodenly at the floor when he told of her leaving after he'd told her that he thought her father was dead. Commander Ironfist said,
General Danavis has been living in some backwater village all this time.
He glanced at Liv.
Sorry, I knew we had a Danavis at the Chromeria, but I didn't think you were related.
He cleared his throat and shut up.
I wouldn't be surprised if he did get away, Gavin said. The General was always a wily bastard, and I mean that in the best possible way.
Liv grinned, weakly and briefly. Kip told them the rest of it. After he finished, Gavin and Iron Fist shared a look.
The Broken Eye?
Iron Fist asked.
Gavin shrugged. Impossible to know.
Of course, that's the point.
The what?
Kip asked.
My Magisters told us that was a myth,
Liv protested. The Prism and the commander of the Blackguard turned to look at her. She swallowed hard and stared at the floor.
Iron Fist said,
Your Magisters are partly right. The Order of the Broken Eye is a reputed guild of assassins. They specialize in killing drafters. They've been rooted out and destroyed on at least 3 separate occasions, if not more. No satrap or satrapper enjoys losing drafters who've cost them so much before the end of their natural span. We believe that each time the Order has reformed, it's been without any connection to any of the previous Orders.
To put it plainly, Gavin said, some thug rounds up a few more thugs, hoping to make a lot of money from backstabbing a few drafters, and they name themselves the Order of the Broken Eye, so they can demand hefty payments. It's pure pretense.
How do you know? Kip asked.
Because if they were real, they'd be better at their job.
Kip scowled. His assassin had been pretty good.
It's not to say they're all equally incompetent, Kip, Gavin said. That's the whole point. We shouldn't even have brought it up. It doesn't get us any closer to the real problem. Whether or not the Order is real, someone sent an assassin to kill you. You haven't been here long enough to make any enemies, so it's clearly an enemy of mine. There's only one thing for us to do.
Kip bit.
What?
He didn't want to admit that he had already made an enemy. Surely that tester, Magister Golden, wouldn't have sent an assassin after him, would he?
We run away. Gavin grinned, a reckless, boyish grin, eyes dancing.
What?
Kip and Liv asked at the same time.
Meet me at the docks in an hour. Liv, that means you too. You'll be Kip's tutor. We're going to Garriston.
Garriston? Liv asked.
Pack quick, Gavin said. You never know where the Order is lurking.
He grinned again, teasing.
Oh, thanks, Liv said.
Pack? Kip asked as Gavin swept out of the room.
I don't even own anything.
Chapter 54 The prisoner studied the dead man.
I'm going to kill you,
he said quietly.
I don't die easy, the dead man said, his mouth twitching.
He was seated opposite Dazen in his wall, knees folded, hands in his lap, his pose a mockery of Dazen's own. He glanced at the carefully woven rag in Dazen's lap.
Who would have thought, the dead man mused, Gavin Guile, so patient, so quiet, so content doing women's work?
Dazen studied his handiwork, woven of his own hair as tight as he could manage with calm, cool blue flowing through his body. He wasn't even sure how long he'd spent on it.
Weeks, maybe. It made almost a skullcap, a small bowl. He studied the shiny interior. Finding, perhaps, a flaw, he took a long but perfectly round fingernail and scraped it around his nose, over his forehead, in methodical strokes. Harvesting the accumulated skin and, more importantly, the precious oil with another fingernail, Dazen smeared the oil carefully onto the floor. He was only going to get one chance. After years and years, he wasn't going to mess it up. With a steady hand and skin filled with blue, he gathered more oil and smeared it on the wall directly over the dead man's face.
This doesn't change anything, Gavin, the dead man said. No, not yet, he said.
He stood and drafted a blade. He cut off a hank of his greasy hair. He spat on it and rubbed it against his dirty skin, getting it as foul as possible.
You don't need to do this, the dead man said. It's madness.
It's victory, Dazen said. He drew the blue Luxin blade smoothly across his chest.
If you're going to kill yourself, the wrist or the neck would work better, the dead man said.
Dazen ignored him. With dirty fingers he pulled the cut open and tucked the putrid mass of hair and dirt under the flap of skin. Blood cascaded down his chest, the red
almost tempting him to try drafting directly, but it wasn't enough. He knew that from experience.
He put a hand to his chest and pressed on the wound, holding it closed, slowing the bleeding.
In a few sleeps, the cell would be cleansed with Dazen's weekly bath. Soon thereafter, depending on how well he had planned and guessed, he would either escape or be dead. As long as he held the blue, he found he didn't care much the one way or the other.
Chapter 55 Liv cleared her throat awkwardly as she stuffed clothing into a bag.
I came back here this morning to apologize, she said.
Huh?
Kip said. The clothes in her hand were some lacy undergarments. Distracting.
You know, when you were busy trying to get killed.
Apology accepted?
Kip asked. What was she apologizing for? He shifted the weight on the pack that Commander Iron Fist had given him before disappearing. Apparently it had taken Iron Fist almost no time to gather some spare clothing, a waterskin, tools, and even a short sword for Kip. Kip still hadn't figured out how to get the pack to sit comfortably on his shoulders, though. He'd come to Liv's room to help her pack, but she wasn't making things any easier. He glanced at the short pants again.
They're just underclothes, Kip.
Ach, caught.
They're see-through, Kip said.
How could such a small bit of cloth actually fit a person inside it? Liv looked down and coloured a little, but played it off. She tossed the short pants to Kip, who caught them instinctively and instantly felt awkward.
"Would you check if those are clean?"
she asked. Kip's eyebrows shot off his face and stuck somewhere three floors up.
"I'm teasing. I just moved, and they gave me all new clothes. Everything here is new."
"Except my gullibility, apparently," Kip said.
That was twice in as many days she'd fooled him. She laughed.
"You're great, Kip. It's like torturing the little brother I never had."
Oh, the little brother comparison. Just what every man wants to hear from a beautiful woman. I've just been castrated.
So would I feel more or less awkward holding my sister's underclothes?
Liv laughed again.
Would these be better or worse?
She held up some black lace that looked like little more than two strings tied together artistically. Kip gaped. Then she held them up to her hips and cocked a saucy eyebrow at him. Kip coughed.
"Oh, I think I need to sit down," he said.
She laughed like he hoped she would, but he wasn't completely kidding. He backed up toward a chair and instantly bumped into someone.
"Watch it," Commander Iron Fist said. "You don't want to run into someone with that little sword sticking out."
Kip was too mortified for words.
"Little?"
Liv saw the look on his face and burst out laughing so hard she fell on the bed. She laughed so hard she snorted, a decidedly unladylike sound, and then that made her laugh harder. Turning around, Kip felt Iron Fist's firm hand guiding his pack away from him so he didn't stab him with a scabbarded short sword on top of it.
"Oh, that little sword."
Relief flooded Kip until he saw Iron Fist glance down at the sheer, short pants in his hands.
"You need me to find some in your size?"
Iron Fist asked dryly. Liv snorted again, giggling so hard she was gasping for breath.
"Oliviana," Iron Fist said, "you're done packing, because we're leaving in 5 minutes.
Liv's laughter stopped instantly. She popped off the bed and began rummaging through her things at great speed. Iron Fist let a small, satisfied smirk steal over his face briefly, then he dropped another pack next to Kip's and walked out. Before Kip could ask him about it, Iron Fist said,
"Move it, boy genius. If you haven't figured out the straps on your pack before I get back..."
He didn't complete the threat. He didn't need to. Soon they were striding onto the docks together. Despite his threats, Iron Fist had helped them with some settling of the packs. Mostly that meant moving things from Liv's pack to Kip's. When Kip asked the silent question, "Why are you making me carry her stuff?" Iron Fist had said,
"It's more complicated to be a girl. You got a problem?"
Kip shook his head quickly. As they walked down the docks, past fishermen unloading catches, apprentices of various trades running back and forth, loiterers, merchant women arguing with captains about prices for goods or transit, basically all the normal business of the day, many people stopped whatever they were doing for a few moments.
It wasn't to watch Kip, of course. It was to watch Commander Iron Fist. The man was big and imposing and handsome, and he strode with a total self-awareness. But it wasn't his sheer physical presence that got him so much attention. He was, Kip realized, famous. As Kip turned to see the faces looking at Commander Iron Fist, he could see Gavin walking onto the docks. And if for Commander Iron Fist business slowed, for the Prism it stopped entirely. Gavin walked through, smiling and nodding to people automatically, but they treated him like he was nearly a god. No one tried to touch Gavin himself, but not a few brushed his cloak as it floated past. What am I doing with these people? A week ago, Kip had been cleaning puke off his mother's face and hair while she lay passed out from another binge. In their hovel. With a dirt floor. No one in their backwater town had paid him the least mind. The addict boy, that's all he was. Maybe the fat boy. I don't belong here. I've never belonged anywhere. Mother told me I ruined her life, and now I'm ruining Gavin's. Kip couldn't help but think of his mother's last words, and the promise he made as she was dying. He'd sworn to avenge her, and he'd hardly done anything to keep that oath. They said Orholm himself watched over oaths. Kip hadn't earned anything, and now they were going back. "Hey," Liv said,